brother walked up a while ago and asked us what our subject was. And I said, would you believe the tabernacle? And he said, tabernacle number two. And you know why I said that? Because we did not get through our subject last year. And Brother Ralph made a comment just a moment ago, the similarity, or at least the continuity of these classes. It looks like we're all dealing with this subject in one class or another. And Brother Ralph Curran announced his class or subject. It's looking through the reality through Moses, towards Moses. And it occurred to us it might help us to relate, Brother Ralph, to your very excellent presentation of this thing, that we could paraphrase and say our class might be looking through Moses to the reality. No one's offended by that, will they?
Nope.
Because literally that's what we're doing. Our attempt in this class will approach this subject, as it was seen through the eyes of Israel, and as it was seen through the eyes of Moses and Aaron and the priests, as they attempted to carry out the plan and purpose that deity had with this nation, and the purpose he had with the nation as they were to reflect the light of God's laws among the contemporary nations that witnessed Israel's existence. For the sake of the young people as well as ourselves, I think we do well to at least establish a little bit of the time period that we're dealing with. So just very briefly, we're not going to take up a lot of time, but let's put here this line and we'll put creation here. And here, roughly on the seventh day, we have the fall of man. Now, how far down this period here was it from the creation of man and his fall to the flood? We want to just get some high points of history. About 1,650 years. So let's put it about here. 1,650 years. And then we have this notable judgment of God upon the human family, because from the time of creation of man's fall, at this point of man's history, God in his wisdom saw the necessity to destroy from his earth the human family which he had created, with the exception of eight souls. Then looking from the time of the flood and getting another high point, which is down to the time of the creation of the nation of Israel, where will we put it here? How much further from here down to here?
But in 2,000 years,
the
flood of Abraham,
followed Abraham. Someone else, yeah. Well, what we're doing is just getting us to thinking together. How long a period of time here? Well, roughly, we've got about 850 years. Now, if my figures are right, some of you all might come up and prove it to be an error, but I think it's about 850 years from the time of the flood till we find that Israel has become a nation. She has been formed, and now she comes out at the time of the Exodus, which what? What are you marking over there? You're marking the Bibles. What did you say about
1706,
yeah, before Christ. Yeah. Seemed like I had the figure 1490. I mean, yeah, 1491 before Christ, so we'll put that little parenthesis, 1491 years B.C. So that gives us the time period of what we're dealing with here. And,
Right.
Good. Now, the reason we did this, and I say a lot of times the visual aid helps us, we simply want to see that as far as God looking upon the earth and looking upon this creature called man and all that he created, he had a special purpose for having created man. And you don't have to be too astute to realize that when he says after the creation of the lower forms of animals, He says that he created man in his own image. And this tells us immediately that there was some special purpose for how he created man. Now, with this particular period here, about 1650 years, we'd like to turn to the sixth chapter of Genesis and turn with me there just briefly here. After about 1650 years now, we find that God, who looks upon his earth and upon mankind, and things have transpired upon the earth which have been very displeasing to the Creator. And here is his pronouncement. Here is man and the earth and the conditions as he sees it. Reading from chapter 6 of Genesis, and let's drop down to the 5th verse. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the earth, for it repenteth me that I have made them. Then it tells us that Noah found grace or favor in the eyes of his maker. Now, skip to the 12th verse, if you will, and now the 11th. And the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. Now, obviously, again, if we're reading carefully, these are the pronouncements of God as he saw man upon the earth here. And if mankind, this has nothing to do with the nation of Israel, they're not in existence, but as God looked upon mankind, they had filled the earth with violence, they had corrupted themselves in every conceivable way, they had corrupted his laws, they had corrupted his way upon the earth. So obviously, there must have been law. There must have been divine law, or mankind could not have corrupted his way or his laws. So this is the condition that man is in roughly 1650 years. Now, I think Brother Roberts made mention of the fact that it's wrong for people to assume that there was no law of deity until either the giving of the law of Moses, or even more importantly, they put a lot of emphasis on the teachings of Christ. But in a manner of speaking, we can say that God's law was actually waiting for man. When Adam opened his eyes in consciousness, Edenic law was waiting for him. So really there has never been a period of time in man's history where man was without God's law, or where he was not under restraint or guidance of divine given laws. Now, let's turn to two or three references that are pertinent to our introductory remarks here. Let's go to the book of 1 Corinthians, and the 15th chapter. 1 Corinthians 15, and let's take a look at the 28th verse. It's almost of necessity, class, that we have a few preliminary remarks before we ever attempt to go into this marvelous subject of this tabernacle that was pitched in the wilderness in the center of the camp of Israel. In 1 Corinthians 15:28, the Apostle Paul, writing to the church or the believers of God's covenant people, and he says, when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all and in all. Now, if we had read several verses previous to this in the same chapter, we would have seen that Paul, in addressing or writing these Corinthian brethren, had made mention of the fact that Christ was the first fruits, afterwards they that are Christ at his coming, and then he skips over roughly 1,000 years and tells us that something will be accomplished through the reign of Christ and they that are Christ at his coming. And he skips over roughly 1,000 years and he takes us immediately to the end of the 1,000-year or millennial reign that Brother Bud spoke of. And what has been accomplished is that through the reign of Christ and the immortalized saints, they will have been instrumental in putting down all rules, all power and authority, and then only then can God be said to be all and in all. Now, let's look at a very excellent reference in the book of Numbers. All of us are very familiar with it, but it's very pertinent to what we're going to mention here. Numbers 13:21. Now again, brethren, we're simply trying to put emphasis on the fact that we should learn as Bible students to read carefully what the scriptures say unto us. I think Brother Roth made mention of the fact that it's a sober thought to think that when we approach into this word, that if we treat it with great reverence and with a desire to be educated and to become better informed as to what God desires in us, we will read it more carefully. Now in this Numbers 14:21, here for in the record, God puts himself on record, so to speak, and says, as truly as I live, and that's pretty definite, as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with my glory. There's not any equivocation there. It's not maybe it will be, but it shall be filled with my glory. Now, let's take a look at a very excellent passage in the book of Isaiah. In Isaiah, the 55th chapter, Isaiah 55, and let's go down to the 10th and 11th verse. And brethren, in our minds, we see continuity in these verses that we're selecting. We hope that you will. We simply are making an attempt that we might be thinking along together. In this Isaiah 55, look down at the 10th and 11th verse, and again, God is saying in effect that I have a purpose for having created the earth and for having created man, and he really hasn't told us how he proposes to fill the earth with his glory, but he has put himself on record that he will fill it with his glory, but he hasn't told us the means nor the method. But he further enlarges upon this through another of his servants, meaning Isaiah here, and God says in other words, it will come to pass, for as the rain cometh down and the snow from heaven, and returneth not thither, but it watereth the earth, and maketh it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereunto I send it. I think it's worth our time to just read that same passage from the New English Bible here. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven, and do not return until they have watered the earth, making it to blossom and bear fruit, and give seed for sowing and bread to eat, so shall the word which comes from my mouth prevail. It shall not return to me fruitless, without accomplishing my purpose, or succeeding in the task that I gave it. Now, brethren, when we attempt to look at the encampment of Israel and the tabernacle in the wilderness, what we're suggesting is that we've got to look at it through God's eyes. When we read the writings of Moses here, and he is the author of the first five books of the Bible, Moses is speaking what God tells him to speak. He's not adding his own reasoning, he's not adding his own embellishments in vain. Moses actually is speaking according as the Spirit of God moved his mind or his intellect to speak. And so we are told, in essence here, that God is saying, don't look at it from your viewpoint. What I'm revealing is looking at it through the eyes of myself and what I intend to accomplish in the earth and specifically through this peculiar and unique people called Israel. So therefore what we have revealed in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy actually is a revelation of the divine objectives of God dealing with Israel and the tabernacle and everything pertaining to it. Let's look at Exodus 19 for a moment. In the 19th chapter of Exodus, and let's pick up the 5th and 6th verse. Now, at this particular junction, we have Israel roughly 3 months out of Egypt. And they are now in the environs of Mount Sinai, where the law was given. And here, for the first time, we see a series of ascents of Moses up into the mount to commune with God. And then when he communes with God, he comes down and he reveals this unto the nation of Israel. And if I'm not mistaken, I meant to look this up, but I know there are at least 5 different times that Moses made this journey or ascent up into the mount and spoke with 7. All right, now, check that still. Somehow or another, I knew that there were 5 times, but I really wanted to believe that there were 7 times because, again, anyone who's made just a very study of numbers, and because I've done very little of it, the numeral 7 means perfection or completeness. And I think you'd better than appreciate why I said I wasn't sure. I knew there was 5 times, but I was thinking it was 7. But Chuck, if you can verify that, it fits in very nicely with what we had hoped would be, that the completeness of what God is doing with his nation. But anyway, Moses makes these journeys up into the mount, and then he comes back unto the people and reveals what God has said to him. And can someone tell me what the response of the people is when Moses tells them that this is what God said? All that the Lord has said, we will do. This is their response to it. Now let's see, did we read now the 5th and 6th verse? Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and ye shall be unto me as a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. Again, brethren, in our attempt to read carefully, Moses is caused to express God speaking here, and he says unto Israel, you almost think that they would have been overwhelmed with the honor that deity was conferring upon them. But he says that I propose you a peculiar people unto me. Your position is unique. I have taken you above all the people in the earth. I have chosen you to become an instrument to further manifest my glory in the earth. What a wonderful privilege. What a wonderful privilege that was given to Israel. A wonderful commission that is given to this people. Let's take a look at Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter. In Deuteronomy 7, and this is an extension of this same thought, and my brethren, again, what is written in the scriptures as far as instruction and learning, it's not just filler speech. This is repeated several times, so Israel was told to listen carefully because you are a unique people. God has a plan and a purpose with you above all the people. So listen carefully to what he says. And in Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter and the 6th verse, he repeats it in a little bit different wording. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people. There's an additional special as opposed to peculiar unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. Now let's get another reference in, let's get Deuteronomy 28:9, and I think that'll suffice for the point we want to make here. In Deuteronomy 28:9, And the Lord shall establish thee and hold people unto himself, as he has sworn unto thee, if thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God and walk in his ways. Now it's interesting here that the writer, being Moses, he tells the people again that they are to be a holy, a separate, a peculiar people unto God, but it is conditional. If you keep my laws and my commandments and walk in my ways, ye shall become what I intended to make you become in the eyes of the nations. And I'm not sure where I got this this thought, but it's in some of our Christopher writings, and I thought it was very excellent. If we substitute the word holy people, where we have found it in these references, we can paraphrase without doing damage to the word of God and say in effect that the Lord shall make thee a showpiece to the nations, a showpiece to the nations. Well, if we ask ourselves the question, then what is the purpose in which God chose Israel? Took roughly, what, 230 years to form them from 70 individuals, Jacob's immediate family, from 70 grew into a large number of people, roughly over a period of 230 years, and at the fullness of time, God brought them out. So we ask ourselves the question, what purpose did God have in creating the nation of Israel and looking upon them as peculiar and special unto himself? That we have already suggested, you are to be a lightstand, that then we're putting emphasis on that, a lightstand or a lampstand. And if the laws and the commandments of deity are working in your minds, in the priesthood and in the nation, then as a man thinketh, as a man thinking in his heart, as he reasons upon God's precepts, this nation will reflect the indwelling of these divinely given laws. And as a result, they will be the instrument of drawing all of these nations. I forget which one of these brothers mentioned about the, maybe it was Bud, the Hittites, and what was the other one in there?
Amorites.
They're in that city of Jerusalem, before it had the name of Jerusalem. These people practice the most abominable things. It's unbelievable. Even archaeologists have demonstrated very ably what these people did. These nations were totally given over into idolatry. They had no knowledge of the true living God. And so God, in his mercy, and I think it's very interesting to get God's viewpoint, in his mercy, he says in effect that I have not written off, as it were, all of mankind, but it is my purpose and my plan to use Israel to bring all peoples to a knowledge of the true and living God and the hope of eternal life. And even in the record of Moses, what does he say? What does he say when he's dealing with this, excuse me, I said Moses, I meant Abraham. Then be Abraham shall all families and nations of peoples or language of the earth be blessed. So brethren, again, if we're thinking together, and we hope that we're getting across to you, if we're not, we'll take the responsibility. But what we're saying is God, from the very beginning, intends to fill the earth with his glory. And since man introduced this condition, it necessitated that God would react to that without taking away man's capacity of free will. It necessitated that God take issue with, and the word circumvent may be a little bit misleading, but in other words, to correct this condition which man introduced in that very good condition in Eden, this is the program. And we're still in that program of God, in other words, healing the breach, the severance of the God-man relationship which was introduced here in Eden. So when we look at it, brethren, in this context, and particularly these four books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, we really say in fact that these people really are special. And what a privilege and a blessing it would be to be told that you are the instrument in which I will use in bringing all people to a knowledge of me and the filling the earth of my glory. One other reference there, let's look at Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter. And let's take a look at the 6 through the 8. I think, yeah, that's the right reference. I think it's very interesting, brethren, that here, if you please, and we did some research on this, and we feel we're on fairly safe ground, we feel that these references here have a good way of summing up some of these preliminary scriptures that we have tried to introduce here. And true enough that the nations recognize that these people are special unto this living God. They begin to recognize it. And so Moses again revealing the nations looking upon Israel, and as Israel begin to apprehend what God had in mind for them, look at the 6th verse here. Let's look at the 5th. Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, that ye should do so in the land whither ye go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear these statutes, and they shall say, surely this is a great nation. It is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great, who hath God so nigh unto them, as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? For what nation is there so great, that hath statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law that I set before you this day? I think, brethren, that God has established to Israel, as well as to any who are interested in consulting the record, that this was Israel's commission. Israel was to be a lampstand, that lampstand that we will deal with later. They were to be a lampstand in the surrounding darkness. And they, through the indwelling of these divinely given laws, and as we said earlier, as a man thinketh, so is the man, if Israel had really kept the law, if they had loved it and kept it and walked in it, their actions, their natural life, their family life, their religious life would have reflected it, and there would have been many peoples living contemporary with Israel who would have been drawn to that marvelous light stand, and there would have been multitudes rejoicing in the true and living God of Israel. But there's a fly in the ointment. Did Israel keep the commission that God had given them? The record tells us that they didn't. What a pitiful and pathetic thing is that Israel, after all of these admonitions and all of the detailed instructions given in this law, that Israel failed to keep the commission that God had entrusted to them. I think it's fair to say, is there a lesson for we consider ourselves Israel. We are spiritual Israel. So in that context, as we examine this record, is there some kind of lesson, is there some kind of exhortation that we can glean from this study, that in other words, it will benefit us in our desire to be what we should be as we attempt to work out our salvation, as Bud mentioned in this New Jerusalem sequence of things. What's the lesson here? Is there a lesson? Is there a word of exhortation to us? Are we exceeding what's intended, or are we to really glean from this a message to ourselves? Anyone?
Isn't that the same promise Israel?
Mm-hmm.
The Lord has spoken.
Now,
the Lord has spoken, we will do, be obedient.
Have we made that promise, brother, in a very simple way? Have we made some kind of an agreement? What is a covenant? But an agreement between two or more parties. All that the Lord, absolutely. When we are baptized, we said anything. It's not anything new, brethren. We're reviewing. We're not presenting anything new to the brethren, but what we're saying is that our baptism, we as Israel, standing there, we said in effect, all that the Lord had required of us, we will do it. And we fully intended to do that at the Lord of the baptism. This was our desire, to fully carry out what God had intended for us. Well, for Israel to have accomplished the purpose for which God intended, what had to happen? I'm thinking of one word, but I know what the word is naturally, but I'm wanting you to think, what word am I thinking of? Something had to happen to Israel collectively as a nation. It had to be taught through the priest, and they had to experience this. But the nation of Israel had to. What one word am I thinking of? This had to happen to Israel before they could have accomplished the purpose of God of being this light. Well, let me ask you, what was the condition of Israel when they were in Egypt? Would you say that they were a spiritually minded people? Were they deeply embedded in the truths of God? And were they really reflecting this and manifesting these things among the Egyptians now? They were in a pitiful state, weren't they? And obviously, if God intended to deal with them down there, he would have done it down there, but he brought them out. He brought them out. So what one word might I be thinking of?
Freedom.
Well, he said freedom. You said what?
Belief.
Well, the word I'm really thinking of is regeneration. Israel themselves, if they were to be this lifestyle, they had to have a regeneration. There had to be a renewing of their covenant before they could attempt to be anything to the surrounding nations. Well, as we said, they failed in that. Now, let's look at Numbers, the second chapter, and take a look now at the encampment itself. You don't need the Bible, brethren, but we're going to try to read all of these chapters. What we're going to do is take just a few selected verses from Numbers, the second chapter. And again, I think that any of us who have studied this subject and read it, that you can't help but become conscious of how much detail are in these four books. And first thing you know, you find yourself reading with a great deal of caution. In fact, you're reading in verses, and then you're down to words in verses, because really they're pregnant full of meaning here, and you can't just overlook them. So here in Numbers, there is a reason why God incorporated in his word, telling us how he arranged the camp. So let's take a look just for a moment here. Now this is going to be the difficulty, because they're working on the back here. This is one panel of what we have here, and I think most of you have seen this, because this has been in a number of preachers that I have visited. Now some of you have seen this, so I'm going to put this right here by the blackboard just temporarily. But I do have a painting of the encampment of Israel, and I just want to briefly show it to you. Yeah, here it is.
Put this
panel. Yeah, Jim,
I believe
you'd be better there. It's a little bit distracting trying to. Now, brethren, I want you to take a look at this panel here. That's much better, isn't it? To those of you who were with us last year, now we did not have this panel in our possession last year. We have two more added to our series, but I think it would be interesting to those of you who were not here last year that a sister in the truth by Sister Irene Medlin from Conway, who's 80 years old, did all of these for me. It's really marvelous when you talk about working in the vineyard, here is a sister 80 years old, whose eyesight and hands are steady enough that she did this series of marvelous paintings and you have here. But this one I did not have in my possession, and it's a real delight to have it. But here, we gave her briefly the outline of what we wanted. And there is some discrepancy in some things, and we'll try to point it out as we go along. But basically, revealed in these panels, we have our subject here. And I'm a great believer in visual ladies. Now, looking at that encampment, again, putting emphasis on the fact that this thing is not given in a general way. There's so much detail. That encampment, why was it done on a circle? I can't think of Al's wife's name. But why was it that encampment in a circle? A circle in a lot of ways is more advantageous than a square. Why did they make a circle out of the camp? It's a reasonable question. God, you know, is pleased with our...
Well, they
hit the
four sides
because
each side meant something. They had a standard, and
they
could have divided the circle, I suppose, too.
All right, but that is saying, in effect, well, if it's on a square like that, and we've already said, let's read carefully, obviously, what you all say, that in the record that's been given us, that there must be somewhere in these four books, that tells us that this is the will of. Do you recognize that?
Right?
Yeah, we know that that's right.
Mm-hmm.
The camp itself many times was referred to as holy ground. holy ground. So all of that enchantment, in one sense, God pronounced upon his holy ground. And there's a very interesting thing put in the record to emphasize to us what God means when he says that. You remember what I'm talking about? Again, giving you a thing. Very peculiar thing that's interjected into that record. And brethren, again, God intended for Israel, as well as us, to get the message. Speaking of the holiness of the ground, and he's dealing with this nation, he said that when the time came for anybody in the camp of Israel to eat himself, they went outside the camp. And there's a description given, I can't remember what book it is, a description given of a method of keeping this camp clean and taking care of those natural functions of Israel. Now, brethren, that's put in there for a purpose. All Scripture is given by the inspiration of God, and it's profitable for certain things. That tells us something. Do you suppose Israel complied with that? There's sanitary laws that were to be met in that camp there. Now, is there any questions or any comments? All right, what we have here then, well, I'm not going to read from these numbers, but if you want to put in your notes, Numbers, the second chapter, is a detailed description of the tribes, their numbers, their princes and leaders, the position that they took in the camp. Mind you, all according to God's directions, not there. Can you imagine, again, brethren, to help us appreciate what's involved here, can you imagine what would have happened if there was a lot of confusion as to about who was going to pitch where? Well, all of that was eliminated. God told them how to pitch it, the standards, and so forth. So there are 12 tribes pitched here according to God's specifications, and you'll find this detailedly given in Numbers, the second chapter. Now, so what we have here then, in looking at that camp, in looking at the camp of Israel here, we've got the camp. We'll put that up here. Now, right off hand, what we have next, we're told about. In other words, now we're becoming selective. There's a separation going on, even in the camp. Israel has been separated from Egypt. Israel has been separated from the nations. They have been called out, separated ones, set apart. But even in the camp, we find that this principle is carried out in the camp. So we have the camp, and they're told where all of these tribes were in the camp, and how they were stationed and positioned. So we have the camp, and then the next thing we find in Numbers 3, in Numbers 3 we have a description of an even more select people, a special people in the camp, the Levites. So then we have there, and in that third chapter we have a description of them and their numbers. We have the Levites. Now, brethren, in one way of speaking, there's method in our madness here. There's a principle involved here. Just like there is in his class and in Bud's class there. There's principles involved. And when we see them, we can apply them with real assurance as we investigate the Word of God. Now, what comes next? We've got the Levites. And roughly there was, I'm thinking of a figure 23,000. I can't remember out of my name. Anybody can see it?
22,000.
22,000, which is a bigger number than five. Well, brethren, you can't see it in this, but in that encampment there, these Levites were chosen out of all of Israel, and they were told where to pitch their camp, and they pitched within the perimeter of the camp. And there was a great, I don't know what the distance is, you know, you get into there. I'm not sure what the distance was between all of the camp of Israel and the tents of the Levites, but there was a broad, open space area there. Before, if you came down out of the camp and was walking towards the tents of the Levites, built on that square there, you would have had to traverse a large, open space all over around there. There was a great distance between the camp of the Levites, the tent of the Levites, and the rest of the camp. All right, now, there they are, Charles.
I just
want
to ask,
if they're
going
to
have
a square
within the square.
Right,
so
right.
Around the
right, all right, now, Charles, that's very nicely introduced to another special people.
They, we have the tents of the camp, the tents of the Levites, then we have the tents of Moses, and Aaron and his sons. So let's put this up here. Let's see here. A, right? A, son. All right. Again, brethren, a principle is developing here. The tenth of Moses and Aaron's sons, and again, the record tells us where they were to be, and what part of the tenth, what side, when speaking of directions, were they? The east side. And every time that Israel, you know, this camp moved several times in that 40-year period of time here, that camp moved, but when they did, they were always told to pitch the tabernacle facing the east. So wherever it pitched, the tabernacle all faced the east, and Moses and Aaron's sons' tents faced the tabernacle, or looking towards the west part of the camp, but they've been looking towards the tabernacle there. So we've got the tents of Moses and Aaron. Now what do we have? Is there anything else involved here? Anybody think of anything else? Because we're dealing with a principle. In other words, God says, according to the pardon, according to the law that I've given thee. What are we speaking of?
Priest.
Got a priest, all right. So we've got the priest. All right, what next might be interjected there?
High priest.
Huh? Right. All right, the high priest. Anything else?
The Almighty.
All right, now he's pursuing it. He said the Almighty. Anything else? All right, what we've got now, we've got the actual tabernacle itself. Now, but we've got one other thing before you even get there. You've got the court. Before we start thinking, I thought someone did. All right, let's put it over here, and the reason I'm doing it is because it's important, but yet I don't want to interject it on this side, but let's put it over here, the court. Meaning that open space that Brother Ralph referred to, where this large altar was, the burnt offering, as well as the labor, where we've got the court on the courtyard, and then we've got the tabernacle itself, and we're going to put the tabernacle here. All right. When we get to the tabernacle, we find that it's divided. It's divided into two compartments, or two sections. What are they? All right, let's put that over here. Can everybody see those? All right, let's put the holy place. And the demon is still there. So then we've got a principle that says, in effect, that even after Israel was called out, that God is teaching and instructing, now I see Brother Ralph nodding his head, God is teaching and instructing Israel, you've been called out and you're separate and set apart, but in my dealing with you, it must all be done according to my laws and according to my commandments. You don't interject your own ideas. So you've got the tent, then you've got the tent of the Levites, you've got the tent of Moses and Aaron, then you've got the priests, you've got the high priest, you've got the tabernacle, and that was it, you've got the court over here. So in that order, in the way that we put them up here, what might be the lesson? I hope somebody comes up that says, gee, we're always saying, what is the lesson? Someone that might not have been with us last year, because some of this we have touched on. What is the lesson here?
The approach to holiness.
The perfect arrangement, but like you said, it's the approach to holiness. The approach to holiness. Now, with this idea in mind, do you suppose that that the camp of Israel became very conscious of how they would circulate around this this area here? Well, again, brethren, let me just briefly get another panel here and hold it up. Let's get a close-up of this. Now, this one we did have. Some of you have remembered this one. There's the tabernacle, and here's the courtyard that we spoke of. Now, it's interesting again, and notice the detail. The detail is just, it's amazing how much detail is in it. It didn't say, God didn't say unto Moses, pitch the tabernacle, period. Pitch the tabernacle, gather the best materials that you can, pitch it, and then put a fence or a curtain around it. Didn't say that off. He told them to pitch this curtain area there, but he told them to use
fine linen, and they told them also how high to make it. And that enclosure there, that fine linen curtain around that tabernacle, is 7.5 feet high. Now, why have it 7.5 feet high? Why not have it, say, 3.5 feet or something like that, so anybody could walk around and look over it and do it? In the dynasty, brethren, again, what God said to Israel, you just don't commonly and vulgarly look over anybody. In other words, the eyes of Israel could not just, you know, just look upon it. Now, this is high now. This is over 15 feet higher. They could see part of the Mishkan, that's the Hebrew word for tabernacle. They could see that. But they could not see what was going on in that courtyard, not unless they were there at the door of this thing. Israel could not have come there and seen what was going on there. Now, what might this have said? If I were living in the camp and you were living there, and we had nothing to do with the Levites, and we had nothing to do with the priesthood, what might this suggest to us? Would we feel that we were kind of excluded from something?
Yeah.
Well, what would we have? We'd say, look, there's limitations put upon my communal building in the camp and what I can do there. So these individuals living in the camp, they couldn't go into that area and frequently. Only the priest worked in that area there. So again, God is saying, separateness, and I will be sanctified in them that draw near unto me. So the principle is being kept inside of. And Israel learning the principle. Now, if anybody had been so foolish as to gone contrary to those instructions, they would have been struck dead. We have one example with Class 1, where the censers of strange fire. It was your class that did better, right? Here's Nadab and Abihu. They heard these laws. They understood the instructions. They very definitely understood what was involved here, but their problem was that they were lusting after, or they coveted a little more of the glory that Moses and Aaron had. So they said to themselves, and I said, look, we too are going to start offering. Mind you, in sincerity, they said, look, we've got the censer, and we'll take the fires over. But they didn't get the fire from the altar, so that's not the problem in itself. Not only did they not take the fire or the coals from that altar out in the courtyard there here, which is the altar of their offering, it was strange fire. And as Brother Wright suggested, they got it from somewhere other than the altar, and the result was that they died because of their disobedience. Do you suppose that that lesson was forcibly brought home to Israel when they saw these men die? In what class again was it? It gave us the instructions that certain ones were able to get these bodies in their
homes.
The uncle of Aaron. Yeah. Now, any questions or comments? I hope some of you aren't going to sleep. I have anything to tell you, you wait. Any questions or comments? How much time do we have here? Okay.
When I was this place to the east, I know it was because of obedience to God, and that's what you said.
All right, this brother was asked, why was the tabernacle facing east? Right?
Because of the face east, so that man would not worship the sun to begin with. He turned his back on it. But the kings of the sun rising will come from the east.
This is the number one, but it is true too that they were forbidden to think in terms of worshiping that heavenly body set out there in the heavens. But there's two things involved. Number one is, and that Israel might not be tempted to worship that ball of energy out there, and also, and more importantly, that the Son of God, in his brightness and glory, comes from the east with healing in his wounds. We'd have to be kind of different, but in other words, I consider it a reasonable big subject, but in God's language, he's really speaking in kindergarten language, in a way, so we can grasp it. But all of these things tell us that. It's telling us something. Now, in this arrangement, again, of this, what did it say in effect to Israel? Again, this is an important part to Israel as well as to ourselves. With these restrictions, which are so obvious in the camp, what did it tell us?
Tell them that the approach was orderly and according to God's way and not their own way.
Right. all of them listen according to God's will, not their own, but it also told them something about themselves. It's really a paradox here. God says, you are a peculiar people. You are to draw near to me. You can enjoy the fellowship of deity, the God-man relationship. But everything about the tabernacle, everything about their brethren, told them and reminded them continually from day to day of their natural uncleanness and their sin condition. A constant reminder. Now, it just comes to my mind, dear brethren, and I think it's relevant, and I think you'll appreciate the point. It just popped in there. Can you imagine anyone believing in the immortality of the soul and the innate goodness of man and appreciating what's involved here? How could you possibly approach God in the proper spirit if you really believe that you had an immortal soul in you and that man is innately good and that he's not separated from God in that sense and that if you let him out, he'll blossom out, as it were? Even the doctrines of Christianity teach that they do not understand the principles of man's natural uncleanness and his sin nature. And more importantly, brethren, and the Christadelphians are unique in this way. The Christadelphians are unique in this way. We don't say this boastfully. When we start examining this subject in the light of Christ, as well as the body of Christ, he's the only one that meets the conditions. And even Christ himself bore the sin nature. And as Brother Ralph knows very well, and he's going to bring out, I'm sure, in his class, even Christ, being prefigured in this, he had to meet those conditions just like Aaron had to meet them. You suppose Aaron could have gone in any time he would have been? How many times did Aaron go into the most holy place? Once a year. Was there any restrictions when he went into the place? He was told what to do. And of course, Aaron, being a type of Christ, we can see, therefore, that God is saying, in effect, that man by nature is unclean, he's separate from God through his sin nature, and there will not be God all and in all until man has changed not only his character, but he will have necessity to have a change in his very nature before he can have be at one with God.
Even when Aaron went in, he wasn't sure that his sacrifice would be acceptable.
So more bells on his guns,
and
they stopped ringing.
Well, that meant the sacrifice was not
acceptable. He could have died
in the most holy place.
That's an interesting fact that I heard somewhere, and I'm going to give to you for what it's worth. I don't know where I heard this, but it's been quite a number of years ago, and it made quite an impression on me before I ever thought I'd get this involved in this subject. But I remember some brother, either I heard it at a school, or I read it through Brother Roberts or someone, but I remember they gave this description, and it made an impression on my mind. They said that when Aaron went into the most holy place, and there was the separating veil, that when he went in, the devil said these bells were at the bottom of his priestly garments. But they said that there was a cord. I don't want to say one. Some of you are nodding. You must have done. But they said that there was a cord around him, and that if those bells had ceased to jingle as Aaron was going through his ministry there in the most holy, it would be indicative that he must have been struck dead because he did not do it according to God's specifications here and his law. And this was the only thing, since no one would have been permitted to go beyond the veil into the most holy of God's presence, consequently the only way that Aaron's sons could have gotten their father out of there was that cord would have been trailing out off and under that veil, and they would have drawn a knife. It's interesting, brethren, but in the study of this, and I looked and I looked and I looked and I never found it, and it looks to me like some brother got carried away. And you got it in balance.
So that's a good place to stop. Really is. That's a good place to stop.